Hello everyone, welcome to Trolling with Logic for 5th of May 2013 at 6 p.m. in the UK, 1 p.m. Eastern Time in the US. I'm your host for today, Zulu, or Trolling with Logic. We do take live calls, so if you do want to call in to speak to our guest, you add the Skype contact Trolling with Logic. And please bear in mind, when you do call in, you are granting us permission to use your likeness because the show is uploaded to YouTube and iTunes for later viewing. Without further ado, I'll quickly introduce my regular co-panelist Martimer. Always good to have you.
Hi everyone.
So we'll very quickly introduce our special guest. I hope I've got the titles right. Director for African Americans for Humanism and director of the Outreach for Center of Inquiry. Have I got that right? And welcome, Debbie Goddard.
For Center for Inquiry. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. So I think what we usually do with most of our guests, we'll go back to the beginning with you and kind of the journey you took. You know, were you from a religious family and how did you end up becoming a non-believer? And
sure. What length should I try to aim for? A 1 minute story? Like a 30 second story? Like a 2.5 minute story?
Go for it, because we've got 90 minutes, so...
90 minutes. All right. Well, I grew up in Philadelphia. My mom is an immigrant from Trinidad. My dad was a Polish Jew, American, but his parents were Polish. And my parents sent me to Catholic school because in the area of Philadelphia I grew up in, the school districts were terrible, and the Catholic school academic standards were much better. There were fewer behavioral problems. So... somewhere around sixth grade, so I was about 10, everyone in my school was supposed to go through the sacrament of confirmation together, and I had some doubts. I expressed them. My teacher said, no, of course you're going through with confirmation. I still wanted to get out of it because I wasn't quite sure about whether I was picking the right religion. So I told my dad I wanted to convert to Judaism, and don't tell mom. And he said, that's great. We'll talk to Rabbi Greenberg about it. So I thought those were my two options, be Catholic forever or be Jewish forever. And then I wondered how I didn't know that the other religions out there were right. And there were so many religions in my region, because I did grow up in a big city, that I saw Hindus. I barely knew what they believed. I didn't know what Muslims believed, but there was a mosque near my 7-Eleven. And then I thought, well, maybe there are so many different stories because there is no God. And for me, I thought I was the first person in the world to think of this ever, because I had never heard that as an option before. So I was really excited to tell my teacher, Sister Therese, the next day. She was less excited. I got in trouble. And it wasn't until a couple years later that I saw the word atheist, but I didn't know any. My parents weren't too bothered by it, of course, fortunately, because my mom was taking classes in college to be a nurse, and my dad... He just, you know, he wasn't Catholic, so it didn't really matter. In high school, I started a philosophy club at a Catholic private all-girls school. It ended up being one of the causes for me losing my scholarship halfway through my sophomore year. So then I went to public school, started another philosophy club, but was much angrier about everything. And weirdly, one of my friends from philosophy club became an atheist, went to college, started a campus group called Campus Freethought Alliance at the University of Pittsburgh, invited me to a student atheist convention basically about 13 years ago now. And I was like, a what? You know, this was 2000. I was 20 and internet wasn't like it is now, of course. So I went to this random conference about 400 miles away in Buffalo at CFI's headquarters. I had never heard of the Center for Inquiry. I didn't know there was a freethought movement. I didn't know that atheists organized, and I was blown away by what there were about 35 or 40 students there, and all the things that they were doing on campus, and the fact that there was a building and paid staff, and there were these books dedicated to this stuff that I was really interested in, but kind of doing on my own. You know, I was studying philosophy because I wanted to teach critical thinking, and all of a sudden I'm like, there are these books out there that I had no idea about. And so I started volunteering when I got back to Philly with all the groups I could find. I volunteered with the Center for Inquiry's campus outreach program for years. I worked part-time in their office in New York City for a while, commuting from Philadelphia one day a week, which is about 2 hours trip each way. And then about 2006, they hired me. And my first job was doing campus outreach and community organizing. And eventually, just I guess in 2010, I also became the director of African Americans for Humanism. And now I'm the director of outreach, so I oversee the operation of the U.S. branches, which range from buildings with paid staff to just volunteer-run groups, and we have about 17 of them. Also, the campus outreach program, which is about 270 groups worldwide, but most in the U.S. and Canada. But there's like 4 in Kenya and 4 in Brazil and all over the place, 20 in Australia. And then also African Americans for Humanism, which is a network of about, I think we're up to 16 groups across the U.S. and growing.
Okay. So what, I'm going to focus on African Americans for a second. So what's that all about? Why did it start up?
There's a story about how it started. The person who was the director before me was Norm Allen, and he's black. The apocryphal story is that he attended a conference in 1989 and stood up at the mic at one point and said, "I love what you do. Everything is great, but why are there no black people?" I don't think that's what actually happened. From what I can tell better is that he actually wrote a letter to the magazine that one of the two magazines CFI publishes, Free Inquiry, and said the same thing, basically, like, "I love the magazine, I love what you do, but I never see black people represented in this movement. I never see them writing for this. Why? Where are they?" And Paul Kurtz, the founder of the Center for Inquiry, said, "You're hired." And he moved up to Buffalo and launched African Americans for Humanism. It was very uphill because African Americans are a very religious minority. And so for years he did that. He also became one of the international branch directors for CFI and actually focused a lot on organizing groups in Africa and the West Indies, the Caribbean. He wrote a couple anthologies about African American humanism, and I took over for him in 2010, but it had been around, therefore, since 1989. It also published a quarterly newsletter. We're moving that over to blogs and online stuff, but there's really been an explosion in interest recently, just because I think atheism's become sexier. There's been an explosion in people participating in the secular movement.
I was just going to focus, because we've had, like, you know, Graydon Square and Tombstone on before, so what's kind of the challenges, like, for an African American coming out as an atheist? I mean, are they under a lot of pressure and a lot of stigma if they do?
Yep. Yeah, because African Americans are, because they're such a minority group, and because of the socioeconomic pressures of being, you know, many feel that African Americans have been stuck in an underclass, you know, history, discrimination, civil rights issues, going back to slavery and whatnot. Certainly, if you look at any demographic measures, they're living in poorer areas, they're doing worse in school, their school districts are getting less money, you know, there's a lot of deep issues, and the civil rights movement was recent. I sometimes people forget that, you know, our grandparents here were involved in that sort of thing. You know, some people can tell stories about marching with Dr. King. So there's still kind of the recoil from that. And there's a lot of the history, the narrative of how blacks even came to be where they are today in the U.S. is that Christianity was a crucial, crucial part. It's the only thing that, you know, kept them going. It's the only thing that got them through difficult times. It's the only thing that got them through slavery. And so to turn your back on religion is to turn your back on your race and your history. And being an atheist is seen as it's being white, basically. You know, black people aren't atheists. There aren't public black atheists out there. What do they, you know, when black people win awards and things, they thank Jesus. That's part of the culture, that's part of the narrative. I think it's more acceptable for a black person in black culture to convert from Christianity to Islam than it is for them to become an atheist because they're less black. So that's something that's different than the story that a lot of white atheists tell, where, yes, they've got that struggle of, like, you know, oh, my gosh, I'm an atheist, my whole family's religious, but rarely does someone say, well, you're less Irish now. You're not an Irish-American. Turning your back on your Irish race. You're turning your back on your family, sure, but, like, your whole culture. And so many black people, you know, when we say black community, like, really a lot of people have the experience of being part of this close community. You know, history has ghettoized black people in the U.S., a lot of times the organizing spaces for them were the churches. And so really, it's not just like, well, I'll just hang out with my white friends now. It's like, no, this is everything. You know, this is your family. This is your culture. This is who you go to the bars with. These are the people that understand you. And they're like, what? Atheism? No, that's, what is that? Jesus. Yeah. It's all Jesus.
I find that pretty interesting that, okay, I get why, they would have turned to Christianity during slavery. I mean, to get comfort in religion. What I don't get is why they associate that with their race. Wouldn't it be like more like from my perspective as a Swede, if I wanted to talk about, you know, a religion that is associated with my, quote, race, unquote, it would be the Odin and Thor thing, not Jesus.
Right.
Wouldn't it be more like, I don't mean to be offensive here, but like, wouldn't they go back to worshiping the great Juju or something like that?
So there
that just
is
sounds
that.
More appropriate, I think.
But, I have two responses to that. One is, it's like telling an Irish person, why are you so Catholic? Don't you know your people aren't supposed to be Catholic historically? No, of course they're Catholic. They're not sitting there philosophizing about, like, the history of their gene tree. They're like, you know, my parents were Catholic, my parents' parents were Catholic, my parents' parents' parents were Catholic, my parents' 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 parents were Catholic. Like, everyone, like, we are Catholic. I mean, it's like another example that might not resonate so much with you is because Swedes have been there for quite some time, but like Americans are, most of us are pretty new to this country, but you can't tell us we're less American, even if we identify as German, French, English, American, like we're American. And if someone's like, you know, you're not really American because your people have only been here for like 120 years. Like, that's not a thing. It's in our core. It's part of our core identity. So saying, like, well, don't you realize, like, 400 years ago, you guys weren't Christian, like, that barely resonates with people who are religious. That was the first piece. True. In the same way that, you know, telling someone they're not American because their people have only been in America for 120 years, like, that, what? Of course they're American. Second is, in the African-American atheist culture, mostly online, but actually somewhat in-person communities too, we do see people who reject Christianity because it was a set of European ideas, Eurocentric ideas that was foisted on black people.
Yeah.
And they go back to what they see as, you know, original African religions. So they identify often as atheists because they reject theism, but they go back to something that's not really in line with humanism. And there are some groups online that have too loud a voice, in my opinion, who are promoting this kind of Afrocentrism and black nationalism that is not scientific but is also atheistic. Because
sort
of what you said, they're doing exactly
animism type thing. Or something.
They're like, you know, science was invented by the Africans. That God was really the chief. They tend to be sexist, homophobic, and lots of other things. And we have a group that actually makes a cable access show regularly that comes from that perspective, and they say, you know, homosexuality, for example, isn't scientific. It's not evolution. That's something that Europeans brought to Africans. And so they're hugely anti-homosexuality, anti-same-sex relations, and they are atheists. We don't usually see that sort of virulent bigotry from that perspective in the atheist community, but we do see it in pockets of the black atheist community.
Yeah, it's not a theistic thing to be anti-homosexuality. It's more of a religious thing, it seems. But what you said reminded me of a video that's available on YouTube. I don't know if you're familiar with the Eat Da Poo Poo parody that was done.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I should laugh or cry at that. I mean, it's just... Ugh.
Yeah, the video I thought you were going to mention is the cable access series here. Low-budget videos made by a group in Atlanta that... Many organizers in the African American atheist and humanist community don't even mention, but I will here just so you know I'm being complete, because we don't want to give them any attention. There was a group in Atlanta, it's been around for, I don't know, a half dozen years or so, called the Black Nonbelievers of Atlanta. And within that group, there was a strain of kind of black nationalist leaning types who were sexist, who were homophobic, etc., who are bringing this, like, back to Africa kind of idea. And they ended up not being a part of the group anymore and starting their own group called the Black Atheists of Atlanta. So they make, I think, maybe weekly YouTube shows. And they have a big African flag hanging behind them. And they're some of the most virulently homophobic and sexist people out there. And so the rest of us just... we don't talk about them. We don't link to their stuff. And then occasionally someone will be like, they'll look up, you know, black atheist groups, and they'll find the Black Atheists of Atlanta and go, oh my gosh, what is this? We're like, yeah, we don't agree with them. They're on the fringe of this.
Yeah, and that leads, of course, to the issue of atheism not being a unifying sort of worldview. But the... two atheists might disagree about pretty much everything except for the existence of a higher power.
Right.
So, yeah.
It also speaks to the fact that, I mean, we see a lot in the broader atheist community, which means the generally white atheist community, you know, that people say, why can't black people just go to our meetings? Why do they feel the need to be separate? But there are things that... many of them have to deal with, that the community has to deal with, that many white atheists or many people in the broader atheist community are completely unaware of and unable to respond to or anything, because they're literally ignorant of these things existing. You started by asking about, you know, is it hard for black atheists or African-American atheists to come out to be atheists? And it's like, yeah, there are some pressures. Not a lot of white people are told they're turning their back on the race, for example, I assume. But that kind of black nationalistic attitude that's in some areas of the black atheist community is something that black atheists have to deal with when they get involved with the atheist community too.
So what kind of day-to-day stuff does African-Americans or humanism do? What's your kind of day-to-day role?
Well, as it's one of the three focuses that I have, it depends on the day. But I can tell you what some of our goals have been and how we've changed what we've focused on in the last few years. Since I took over, I've shifted some of what we've done, because I don't have the same talents that Norm had. He was a skilled writer. He was good at researching stuff and putting together articles. He often did letters to the editor, to Ebony and Jet and other black-focused publications. He appeared on radio shows. He was an expert in a way that I'm not on African-American free thought history. And my experience is, as an organizer, I am an organizer, I have experience doing activism, I can get people together, I can, you know, plot out campaigns and try to execute them. And so when I took over, I focused more on community building, in two realms. You know, one is in person. So we provide support to local groups, and that might mean that I have an email back and forth and a good couple phone calls with someone who's like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. I'm so glad to find this. I want to start something up in North Carolina. What do I do? And I'm like, oh, here's what you can do. Here's some connections we have. Contact these groups. Start a meetup. You know, here's, I'll put your information on our website. And so providing that kind of support is one thing that we do, having supporting in-person communities as much as we can, sending them things to hand out if they're tabling, for example. Another thing is to support online communities. So we started a Facebook group, and we were starting some other online forums for people to talk. We have a blog that we're setting up so that people can write articles about stuff, and that sort of thing. So managing the Facebook group is probably one of the Facebook things I spend most of my time on, actually, just considering the groups that I have to manage. There's a lot that goes on there. And it's a really good way for people to connect with each other because, again, like, we're organizing a minority in a minority, no matter which way you slice it. Right now, I'm also trying to get stuff done in person where I live in Buffalo, New York. There's a festival coming up that's big in the black community in Buffalo, and we're going to try to do some tabling and outreach there so we can get a small group going on the ground there. We update... One of the things we're trying to provide is resources. This is also in line with our goals to have a bigger presence of black people in the broader atheist movement. And so I'm working on getting more people on our speakers bureau. Every time I see an academic contact of someone who's writing about atheism and black history, I'm like, hello, what do you do? Do you know anything about us? Do you ever give talks? Do you have one online? Okay, great. Can you be on our speakers bureau? That's fantastic. A lot of conference organizers contact us to find out who they can invite to present on things. And we have kind of a hole right now. We have more and more black atheists who are giving talks about diversity and outreach. So if there's a regional conference, you know, they might have 12 speakers and they're like, okay, we have all white people. Let's find a person of color to talk about diversity. And a lot of people involved can do that. But we'd like to get people of color who are able to talk about philosophy, history, and science. So it's not just the token diversity speaker.
Yeah, it's, exactly. You know,
it's you have a diverse roster of people who are addressing skepticism or something. The hole that I mentioned is it's been a bit hard for us to find black, particularly, but speakers of color who can address skepticism and science. And so whenever I see any leads on that, I send emails out like, you know, hello, this is the purpose of the organization I work with. Would you be interested in joining our speakers bureau, speaking at some of our conferences, etc.? And what we have in the works now to future projects, but I have to lay down a bunch of groundwork before we execute them, is you might not be aware of this term, but we have something called Historically Black Colleges and Universities, or HBCUs, because, you know, 150 and so years ago, schools were segregated, colleges were segregated, and some of them are segregated for cultural and historical reasons, and some of them for legal reasons. Most of them are in the southeastern United States. I think that one way that we can invest in getting humanism and atheism in the black community more is to look to college campuses. And so we're trying to organize a tour of 4 to 10 campuses in a relatively short amount of time, sending some of our speakers out to do events and then signing up people to start a campus group there. But I need to do a lot of groundwork. I need to find someone at the school. I need to find, you know, someone who's willing to put a sign-up sheet out, availability. And we kind of were starting with zero with school contacts. So it's been a little slow. Yeah. I'm emailing philosophy professors and biology professors and some people in African-American studies departments. And I've got about 5 good leads now, but I'm trying to get a dozen. So that's a continuing project. The second future plan is we're starting to work on our next national African Americans for Humanism conference. I'm looking for a venue that's suitable for that. So a lot of the stuff I do is just like putting together spreadsheets, emailing people, collecting information, because we didn't have some of these lists. And, you know, as an organizer, the biggest tool I have is people and connections. And so I have to sort of build people databases and like reach out and make connections. Mm. But so far, like even in the last year, I've probably tripled the contacts that we've had. I'm really excited by how excited people are when I reach out to them. I'm like, I don't know who you are, but I saw you on Twitter. You're black and you do this. Like, would you like to join our network? And they're like, what? I love what you do. And so that's been really, really good.
I was going to ask, does African Americans for Humanism, do you offer the same services as the other humanist groups, like the celebrations, weddings, you know, naming ceremonies and things like that? Do you also do that as well?
I know that's big where you are in Scotland, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much like what we associate with the humanists is like, you know, the weddings, funerals, and...
Yeah, I remember meeting probably a handful of years ago June Maxwell from the Humanist Society of Scotland. Is that her name?
She's also with Secular Scotland. I speak to her now and again as well on Facebook.
Yeah, and she explained how the most popular thing that humanists in Scotland do is... weddings and baby naming ceremonies, I think, and then funerals. Yeah. And I just saw some statistics recently about how popular that is there.
Yeah.
That's not something that groups in the U.S. do as much.
Okay.
Partly it's for legal reasons. The who it is that can perform marriages legally depends on the state. Like, I'm from Pennsylvania. That's where Philadelphia is, for those of you who don't know. And in Pennsylvania, because of our Quaker heritage, you can do a self-uniting marriage ceremony. Two people can basically marry themselves. They don't need a priest or minister there. But in New Jersey, which is right next to Pennsylvania, you need to either get a justice of the peace, I think, or a minister representing a religious tradition. And so if you're an atheist, you have a couple options available to you. You can go online and join the Universal Life Church, which is basically a BS internet church that basically is like, you know, choose your own title. Are you a reverend? Are you a bishop? Are you a deacon? And therefore, you're representing a religion when you do it. Or you can go through a training course from, I think it's the Humanist Society of Friends, and get a certificate. Basically, you're representing, again, a religious tradition legally. But this is something that some atheist groups are challenging. Like, why can't we perform weddings? And so in Indiana, actually, the Center for Inquiry is involved in the court case right now that the Center for Inquiry Indiana should be able to have people be celebrants and have the legal power to marry people. But it's not, because of that hurdle, it's not a huge thing that humanists are involved in the U.S. And we don't really do baby naming ceremonies. Like, once people stop doing baptisms, we don't really have a secular equivalent to that here. So because African Americans for Humanism is a program that's a part of the Council for Secular Humanism, which is a sister organization of the Center for Inquiry, like, we're able to tap into the structure of these other organizations and the support, but there's no separate program for doing, you know, providing celebrants and whatnot. Though CFI has an increasingly large list of celebrants, and the American Humanist Association does too. But it's not a big thing. Humanists don't have that kind of presence or those kinds of numbers here yet.
We do have a chat room question, and it's from DJ Steve. He's asking, regarding how people may not be qualified, isn't there a way they could be trained to speak on the history of black atheism and things like that?
Yes. More people could learn that. I guess we do have a few people now. Like, I'm not qualified to speak about that.
Okay.
I can tell a couple stories about a few people, and I can read up on it. But I can give you an example of something I was asked to speak on that I'm absolutely not qualified to speak about, which is the celebration in Buffalo coming up, too. There's something called Juneteenth. On June 19th, 1860-something, I know Lincoln had done the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed slaves in the slave states in the U.S., but Texas didn't know about it yet. and I might not even be getting this totally right. See, there was a day, June 19th, 1860, whatever, when someone read the Emancipation Proclamation from the courthouse in Texas, and the slaves then knew they were freed. And so they started celebrating it. And in some areas, they still celebrate June 19th, which is called Juneteenth. In Philadelphia, when I grew up, I had never heard of this. It was not a thing. And shortly after I became the director of African Americans for Humanism, I got asked to be on a radio show to talk about Juneteenth. And it was in like 2 days. And I was like, what? No. Like, I can't. I can read the Wikipedia article, which is what my knowledge is from right now. So if we wanted someone to really talk about the history, black atheist history, we do have probably a half dozen people that I can think of right now who are qualified. And a couple of them are college professors, you know, and this is what they do, and they've written books about this stuff. And a couple other people, it's a hobby, it's an interest. So it depends on the level of the conference, of what level of expertise or, you know, professionalism, I guess, too, because there are some conferences that are more casual, where people present on their interests rather than bringing in expertise. So yes, but we are looking for people who can talk about, like, skepticism, who just happen to be people of color, for example. And again, that's a hole. We don't have a lot right now. Or zero. Very few. It's not zero, but it's very few.
Did you have a question there, Marty?
No, not on that subject.
Okay. We've got one from Live Life there, so I say we'll ask that, yeah. And then I think we can move on to the Center for Inquiry Work.
Didn't we cover that one?
Not yet. I think we've.
Oh, okay.
It's been mostly the African American stuff we've been covering. So, like, for the second half, I think we could talk about Center for Inquiry.
No, I'm talking about the question.
All right. Well, we'll ask anyway. Live Life is saying, do you see any differences in black, white, etc. atheist demographics, and if so, what or why? I think you did cover that briefly.
I can go into more, some other things I haven't covered with that. By the way, are my answers too long or are these a good length?
No, they're a great length. Perfect.
Okay, good. I thought maybe, you know, there'd be a million questions or something and I should go faster, but, besides the, I mentioned before the cultural pressures, which are different, and we're talking about broad strokes. You know, there isn't one thing that black means in the U.S. Like, my mother's from Trinidad. She's not African-American, so I grew up with West Indian culture, and, you know, that's a little different than growing up with African-American background. But I'm still black, according to the way that the culture works here. I don't have a sense of what percentage, but I see it often on the Internet and in person. I hear it in person. White atheists in the U.S. and in the U.K. and in other places don't think there should be these separate groups. And it's offensive to them sometimes, to some of them, that there are separate groups. And the places that I see these comments, one place that, like, if you ever see a article about black atheists or black atheism on the Richard Dawkins Foundation forums, probably two-thirds of the comments will be, well, why do they feel like they have to be separate? Why can't I start a, you know, Irish-Italian-Americans for Humanism? And some really long things like, well, there'll always be racism as long as they want to separate themselves. And that's extremely, extremely frustrating, very frustrating. We did a billboard campaign last year for African-Americans for Humanism in February, in Black History Month, and I said that there were four responses that we saw generally. We saw from black religious people, generally it was like, you're wrong and you're going to burn in hell. Then we saw from black atheists, this is the greatest thing ever. OMG, I'm so happy that I found you guys. This is fantastic. Is there a group near me? So that was the black people response. Within the atheist community, which again, largely white, we saw the atheists who are really, really excited that there was this focused outreach effort. And the fourth response was, again, the pissed off, why do they need to be separate? What's wrong with them? Why can't they just join us? And some of them were just really like, I don't understand. Our groups are so friendly and welcoming. Why can't they just join us? Kind of response. Demographically, however, I like to explain it, like why something like African Americans for Humanism exists and why we should still continue to exist from a marketing perspective. You know, like one advertisement doesn't fit all. If you're trying to reach out to college students, you're going to have, you know, beer and pizza and have things later in the day. And if you want to reach out to retired folks, you're going to not have that. You're going to have a completely different kind of advertising. You know, when we want to reach out in the atheist movement to younger people, we do things a certain kind of way because we're like, what speaks to young people? What's going to attract them to our movement? If we want to reach out to women, we might offer more childcare at our meetings because we see demographics, we understand statistics, we know that we're more likely to have women if we offer childcare. If we want to reach out to black people and we don't currently have them, we can think of more effective outreach tactics to reach the black community. And I'll give you one example from Philly that's, you know, obvious to me because I'm familiar with the culture there and the kind of layout of the city. But there was a free thought group that met in the suburbs of Philadelphia that was almost impossible to get to by public transportation. Like, the meeting started at 7, the train stopped running at 8, and you would have to take a train from downtown Philadelphia for about an hour, 15 minutes. And then they said, why don't black people come to meetings? And I was like, where do black people live in this area? They live in the city, you know, the city is like, I forget the fraction, like 3/5 black. The suburbs are like 87% white. Why don't you have your meetings in the city so that other people who right now literally can't come to your meetings could come, because a lot of the people in Philadelphia are public transportation dependent. And that's one change. It's not, you're not saying like, I'm going to find me a black person. You're saying there are reasons in the way that we have our meeting that we're not even thinking about that result in the demographics that we attract. And so what we do in African Americans for Humanism and other related groups, the Black Atheists of America and whatnot, are, you know, what issues are relevant to African Americans, how can we get more of them to our meetings, what resources can we provide, what communities can we build, what topics do we address that they want to talk about. Okay. That's it.
All right. There's another question. Oh, by the way, June is listening into the show and she says hello to you, June Maxwell.
Oh, hi, June. I just talked about you.
Yeah.
I hope you're doing well. Whenever I see a bunch of big yellow school buses, I think of June Maxwell, because when she came here, she was very surprised, but she was very pleased to see yellow school buses everywhere.
There's another question from DJ Steve, and he's asking, is the black community, does the black atheist community short of female speakers as well? And what could be done to improve this in general?
Yes. Oh, let me go back one half second. There was something I should have mentioned in my previous answer, which is that also the black community is much more religious, in any demographics you see, much more religious than whites, Latinos, and Asians in the U.S., which is another reason we don't attract as many. We shouldn't expect equal representation if we just look at statistics. We should expect to have fewer black atheists. All right, so are there fewer women speakers? I'll speak first to this from my own personal experience. You know, I first got involved, as I mentioned, in the summer of 2000, and I've seen a lot of shifts in the demographics since then. But I've had the chance to attend the Amazing Meeting, which is the big meeting done by the James Randi Educational Foundation in Vegas every year. It's the last few years it's been, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 people, 1,600 I think one year. When our conferences look to draw, look to have people who have PhDs and have written bestsellers, or are scientists as the speakers, and the things that they talk about are science and philosophy, we should expect that we're going to see mostly white guys. And in some sense, probably even mostly older white guys as speakers. I don't think the demographics are that much different for your various countries you're in, but I'm familiar mostly with the U.S. one, so this is based on that. But you know, if we're looking in the sciences, we see mostly men getting PhDs in the things that we as a movement are most interested in. If we're looking at the bestseller lists and people who write about science, again, like, that's mostly men. We almost never see people of color who write about science, for example. There's usually one, and everyone's like, what about Neil deGrasse Tyson? I'm like, yeah, name two more. They're like, that's three, Neil deGrasse and Tyson, right? I've asked people before, like, name five black scientists, and they're like, Neil deGrasse Tyson. So that was the case at the amazing meeting.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just thinking, he's not black, but there's he's of Indian descent, but there's a physicist in the UK that's non-white that's getting out and popular on TV as a public presenter. So it's
his name?
I know it's a different ethnic group, but there are others out there.
Is that Jamal?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And actually, we've seen speakers from the UK flown into US things. As I mentioned, most of my experience is in the US. But I remember Alom Shaha wrote an article in The Guardian a couple years ago about the lack of Asian and black speakers in the UK. He had just come back from, I think, TAM London, maybe, and said there was a lack there, too. So I think some of these are applicable across these cultures, across these countries. But yeah, so one change I've seen is that the movement has been, mostly in the last 5 years I've seen the shift, hosting more speakers who are known for their blogging, who are known for their YouTube channel, some of them, who are known for being organizers and activists as well. We're also drawing from some other fields that we hadn't drawn before. So it's not just like the one woman scientist who speaks at every conference or, you know, always bring a black person in to talk about diversity. If we start bringing in organizers, we see a lot more women represented. There was one TAM, and I don't remember which one, maybe TAM 9, where they had near parity or maybe just like a 50-50 split with women and men, and a lot of the women were educators and organizers and activists. They weren't New York Times bestsellers. They weren't scientists necessarily. A couple of them were. And they weren't philosophers. So as we broaden what people are interested in hearing from, because people are organizing groups, because people are engaged in activist efforts, because we're seeing more bloggers who are seen as leaders in the movement and worthwhile thought leaders, I think we'll see more women involved when we value what they have to contribute to.
Okay, and just quickly welcome Womble there. I didn't get the chance.
Hello. Yeah, I hope I didn't sound to interrupt too quickly then.
No,
it's
no problem at all. So I think we'll kind of move on to your CFI work. So can you give us a kind of brief rundown for maybe some of our viewers that don't know what CFI is actually all about?
Oh, man. Man, CFI is about so many things. It's funny to me that was the organization I stumbled on first because of the kind of organization it is. It's in line with a lot of my dearest interests. So CFI is actually three organizations. The oldest was called the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, PSICOP, now called the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. And they've been around since 1976. They're the granddaddy skeptic organization out there. So they do Bigfoot, UFOs. Originally, that was more their focus, psychic powers, spoon bending. Now it's more conspiracy theories. They still do the classic, you know, does the statue cry blood? They do educational programs as well, like teaching critical thinking, media skepticism, which is why the name no longer has the word paranormal in it, because they broadened the scope. That started in 76. In 1980, they started the Council for Secular Humanism. One reason for that was that the other humanist efforts in the U.S. were technically religious organizations, and that was a problem when religious right, the the growing religious right would accuse people of, or would say that humanism is a religion, and in fact the de facto religion of our public schools, therefore Christianity should have a place too. But the Council for Secular Humanism was not religious, it was right there in the name. So they started in 1980, they each published a magazine, Free Inquiry for the Humanist and Secular Side, Skeptical Inquiry on the other side. They always shared space and some staff, and in 1991 CFI started as kind of an umbrella organization for the other two. The outreach department is now CFI. So we have CFI branches, I mentioned about 17 in the US, I think 6 in Canada, and another 17 international locations. And out of the Centers for Inquiry, we do education programs, we do outreach, we build community and things in line with the mission too of the skeptic side and of the humanist side. So we have about 40 people or so that work at the headquarters, which is outside of Buffalo, New York. We've got another 6 in an office in Washington, D.C. I mentioned the other branches. Some of the staff, therefore, is dedicated to magazine production. You know, we have art department, we have mailroom, all this sort of thing, editors. But we also have 3 people in outreach who work with the campus groups. We have the education department, which has seminars. And I know the one in the UK does a lot of education programs. We organize conferences. We set together debates. We get involved in a lot of advocacy stuff. In fact, more and more. Last week, last Thursday, we helped organize worldwide protests against the issues in Bangladesh with atheist bloggers, where there are bloggers who are being accused of blasphemy. And we protested, I think, in D.C., New York City. Actually, in Bangladesh, there was a protest. There's one in London. So there's a whole bunch of different overlapping activities focusing on 5 areas. Let's see if I can get this. Skepticism, atheism, secularism, like church-state separation, humanism, crap. Darn it. The other one. Man, that's terrible.
Flying spaghetti monsterism?
Flying spaghetti. That's not one. Atheism, free thought. Oh, wait, that's not really one. Secularism, skepticism, atheism, humanism. Wow.
You'd have to turn it into an acronym to help you remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the foundation of all of it is critical thinking and naturalism rather than supernaturalism. Yeah. And so it's kind of weird.
That sounds like a great thing, because that's actually sounds like an organization that I would actually be very interested in
working with, because
these are issues that I really care about.
Yeah, each branch operates differently, and it's a little weird because, you know, in the U.S. we have so many national organizations with a focused mission, like American Atheists really focuses on advocacy and civil rights issues with atheism, you know, church-state separation. And Freedom from Religion Foundation has their focus, and a lot of theirs is, like, legal stuff. If you put up a crucifix somewhere, they're there to say, no, take it down. We have skeptics organizations. CFI, we have a humanist organization, the American Humanist Association. We have actually a student outreach one, the Secular Student Alliance. CFI does all of these things. And in some ways, that's a real benefit, because we're able to tap into the resources. You know, like, atheism isn't enough for a lot of people, but we do atheist advocacy. We can put in the humanism and the skepticism in our atheist outreach, you know, and the same with the other sorts of things we do. It's kind of a weird web and a weird history that resulted in what we're currently doing. On the branch level, because I deal with outreach, you know, each branch has its own flavor. In Indiana, because it's generally a very religious state and conservative, a lot of what they do is community stuff. They worry mostly, for some people, it's a support group. It's their one outlet where they get to be a non-believer. That's not so much of an interest in Portland, Oregon, which is a very secular area. But in Portland, they have a lot of woo. They have a lot of, you know, alt-med, they have a lot of homeopathy, they have a lot of crystal therapy, crystal healing. And so the group there is most interested, not most, but more so than in Indiana, they're interested in science education in skepticism. You know, they have a lot of kid programs where they teach kids to be better thinkers. So it all depends partly on where they are. In the Deep South, the biggest interest is kind of atheist activism. Like, if someone's an atheist in Alabama, they're probably militant. Because there's a lot to be angry about. But that wouldn't fly so well in New York City, you know? So it's interesting work.
So it sounds like you've got an organization there that's the scope to, under one umbrella, give everyone a flavor of whatever their interests are.
Yeah, it depends. Again, like, if they're involved in a local group, they might feel like the group's too atheist or too humanist, but in most cities, there's several kinds of local groups, so that's not really an issue. It gives it some flexibility in different areas because there are also international branches. You know, so what CFI Kenya does is very different than what CFI in Moscow does or CFI Romania. In Kenya, it's a lot of anti-superstition workshops and education programs. In Moscow, they're doing more humanist stuff, although they do have an anti-superstition component there, too. A lot of church-state separation, too, in Russia and Romania.
I'm just going to butt in here. What's kind of the most out there place that there's a CFI? Like, have you ever just, like, have you ever had a request from a group and you just gone, wow, there?
Like, Pakistan or Iraq. Wow.
Iraq? All right.
Yeah, there was actually a fellow, his name is Dr. Wujud Lafta, and about 6 years ago, I believe, he started emailing, maybe a little longer ago than that, emailing Paul Kurtz to come to CFI headquarters and do some of the educational programs, but that just, you know, no visas could be arranged for that at the time. About 3 years ago, he actually did come to the U.S. I think he escaped from Baghdad. He escaped from Baghdad to maybe Syria and then Jordan and then somewhere and then came to the U.S., but he couldn't go back for a long time, which was actually very depressing to him because his wife and children were behind. But he said for years he'd been working. He had a subscription to Free Inquiry, and he translated a couple articles for each issue into the dialect of Arabic that they read and photocopy it at the hospital he worked in and pass it around on this little network. And Paul Kurtz was a visionary, a dreamer in a lot of ways, and he's like, let's have a CFI Baghdad. And everyone else is like, you can't. Why are you ridiculous? But they did decide to start, once he headed back, and actually I think to Damascus, they tried to work with some other doctors so they could start translating some humanist and free thought books. And they were working with a doctor named Dr. Muhammad Muhammad for about 2 months before he ended up dying in an IED explosion on a bridge. And that was kind of the end of that effort for the moment. But the fact that that even existed was just, you know, that was a shock to me. There is some effort in Pakistan right now. Again, like people kind of photocopying things and sharing them on underground networks. We do give some support to efforts for education of girls, for example. That's something in line with our mission. And it's a particular interest of mine, I think, because I know that I'm a dumb American in a lot of ways. You know, I have a complete understanding that we're in a bubble here. We don't have other countries that we care about that are close by. We're like Canada, psh, whatever. That's basically giant Minnesota. and then Mexico's got its own things. But we're disconnected. We don't have the same understandings maybe of the world that other you tiny countries do out there. But so when I was 20 and starting to volunteer for CFI, my first volunteer task was newsletter editor for the campus newsletter. And so every month I did a newsletter about stuff happening in campuses all over the place. I solicited articles. And I found out that we had a campus group in Nigeria, and I don't know how to pronounce because I've only ever had to read it, but University of Ibadan. And I emailed them like, hi, my name's Debbie Goddard. I'm the volunteer publications director for the Campus Freethought Alliance, and I wonder if you'd be interested in submitting an article for our monthly newsletter. And someone emailed me back and said, oh, yeah, that's great. We have a group here. I can let you know what we're doing. We're organizing a workshop because here in Nigeria, they've been killing children who are accused of witchcraft, and we're trying to educate people so that that stops or lessens. What kinds of things are you doing in America? That's so cool that you care about what we're doing here. And I was like, oh, we're trying to get under God out of our Pledge of Allegiance. But that's our big issue right now. It's discrimination. Yeah. Jesus Christ, you're trying to stop children from being killed? And I had no idea about that at the time. And this is, you know, when I'm first getting involved, I didn't know what the worldwide movement was like. So since then, I've paid attention a lot more. I stayed in touch with that guy. He's now 34 years old. He runs the Young Humanistas Network in Nigeria. He's building a series of orphanages for these children. He's finishing up his PhD in anthropology. And I got the chance to meet him last year in Oslo, 2 years ago now. And that's blown me away, the sorts of things they're up against in Nigeria. You know, in Kenya, we support a network of campus groups. In Uganda, there's a CFI effort. And recently, some of our people on the ground there worked with LGBT organization that's completely underground basically now to organize the first pride parade, which could get them all killed. And I was in email contact with one of the organizers, and they're like, yeah, we're going to do it. We have to stand up and show people that we're not going to back down, even though one of our leaders has been murdered. I'm just, what? Like, and so when I hear these stories and then people tell me, you know what, atheism doesn't matter, or this doesn't matter, or like, let everyone believe what they want to believe as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. These sorts of stories from these other places, from Pakistan and Iraq and Nigeria and Kenya and Uganda and India and Nepal and other places where I've been in touch with activists, show me that, no, like, beliefs lead to behavior, lead to action, and that the sorts of things that we, the movement, and, you know, we CFI are trying to promote and spread at the core, again, critical thinking and naturalism rather than supernaturalism, are so key, I think, to making the world better.
Absolutely.
In some ways, I'm like a true believer in this stuff. Sometimes I sigh and sometimes I groan, but I really do think, you know, the world would be a better place if there were more critical thinking and less, fewer supernatural beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what you were saying earlier about how the people sort of in the Western countries where they think, oh yeah, let everyone kind of believe what they want to believe. I think they're probably saying it out of ignorance about what happens in some of these countries where you do have children being killed for witchcraft, and it's because they just don't know how bad it can be, and they're just making the, you know, it's not a bad assumption, it's just a naive assumption that everywhere in the world around them is going to be kind of much of a muchness with the sort of environment that they live in.
But at the same time, there are people in the first world countries that choose to pray for their kids instead of taking them to the hospital.
Yeah,
so
that's a big
problem. The problems exist, and this is also a huge problem in even outside of America, and in less religious countries, people believing in alternative medicine and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
trying to cure cancer with water, you know, it just, that hurts people.
Yeah, one of the complications there is, you know, especially in America, if you say freedom, that just resonates so deeply with people. So if you say parents should have the freedom to decide what they want for children, that comes up against the whole, like, they're letting their children die. It's like, well, how does, what, you trust the government to make all the good decisions? You trust the government to know what's best? So that is often a sticky point. Like, we can know what science tells us works, you know, and praying for the kid with juvenile diabetes to get better and not be insulin dependent is not going to work. You know, avoiding giving a blood transfusion to a Jehovah's Witness, if they're hemorrhaging blood, that's not going to work to make that person better. But on the other hand, that freedom of choice just resonates so strongly that I think it's why, for example, the skeptics movement is so cautious or so hesitant to be involved in politics and activism beyond education goals, you know? Because they they can conclude, like, yeah, a blood transfusion is necessary, but it's not part of the skepticism movement to conclude, therefore, we should have laws that forbid parents from withholding medical treatment for their kids.
Well, I think it's part and parcel with, you know, if people want to have their rights, then they need to be aware of their responsibilities. And it's, your right as a parent might be to make choices in the best interest for your child, but you're responsible for their well-being and welfare. And if you make a choice that results in your child being basically dying due to neglect, even if it was the most well-meaning neglect in the world, then there's going to have to be something that can be said to, you know, at least point out that actually, you know, this was a really, really bad choice.
And punishing them, I guess, too. That's, of course, been a huge issue with the vaccines and autism. Mm. The parents who are choosing not to get their kids vaccinated aren't doing it to say, you know, we'll stick it to the man. They're doing it because they think it's the best thing for their children, that, you know, vaccines are bad for their kids. They're doing it in the interest of health, and they're doing it with bad information and support groups online. And how do we get past that? If we do mandatory government vaccines, you know, I don't even imagine that could work here. It probably could offhand, but people wouldn't be happy about it. And so one thing the skeptics movement can do is try to educate people, try to have good information out there to counteract the bad, but they won't necessarily support, like, you know, a mandatory vaccination program or something.
Yeah, that's kind of the results of the anti-vaccination movement are kind of, it's kind of bearing its fruit right now in the UK. I don't know if you've heard about this. There's been a massive kind of measles outbreak here.
Yep. Yeah, I've read a couple
from when the MMR was just shunned because of the quackery of the Andrew Wakefield.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah, and I saw some heartbreaking articles from parents who avoided vaccines, you know, for what they thought were all the right reasons, for the best interest of the health of their kid, and then their kid got measles, and in one case, you know, died pretty quickly, and the parent who wrote the article was just like, I wish I could go back in time and have read this other stuff. I read, you know, they research it and they can find all of this bad information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Womble, did you have a question there? I think you were wanting to talk about secular students.
When I was just listening earlier, I just thought about whether or not when you were saying about trying to get campus groups supported. I don't know whether or not you've ever been in contact with the Secular Students Alliance.
Oh, yeah.
They might be someone that you could use to sort of help trying to springboard some sort of campus-based groups. And I know I heard when you were talking about the whole having a sort of African-American and sort of black atheist groups, there were some people in chat saying about how it could be, you know, it's divisive and how we shouldn't. In an ideal world, we wouldn't need to have these groups, but, you know, as a female approaching a male-dominated environment, I understand that it can be intimidating to go somewhere where you're in the minority, so I can understand why perhaps to help people find their way into sort of the atheism and scepticism and secularism world, so that it might be helpful for them to have a sort of smaller, more minority group-focused group that they could go to first, and then from there springboard into joining the wider world when they're feeling much more comfortable about things.
Right. And as I think too, you know, we want to join groups. If we're talking about participating in groups either online or in person, the thing that brings us back is not just, oh, these topics are of interest. It's also like, I meet some peers. I like hanging out with these people. You know, I want to spend some of my time hanging out with these people. And I remember joining a potluck group in Philly that was largely retirees. And I was 22 at the time. And the things that they were talking about were not things that I was interested in at the time. Like, you know, assisted living facilities and building additions to their house and whatever. And I was a broke college student. I chose not to drive the 45 minutes to go to that group meeting in the future. I chose to do other things with my time. And so part of it is the sorts of things that we address. You know, if I'm a broke college student, there are things that I probably like to do when I hang out with people, but it's probably not like going to an expensive restaurant when you're done hanging out. It's probably going and grabbing a beer and some pizza, as I mentioned, you know, hanging out in a pub. The time of day that the meetings happen, if they meet at 10 in the morning on a Sunday, not in my best interests. You know, the things we talk about, if people are talking about building additions to their house and how much they spend on their new toilets and their new sinks and cabinets, and I'm broke, like, I'm just going to sit there quietly and not participate and be less motivated to come back in and join. So it is like the culture, plugging into people who have a similar background, a similar perspective, similar experiences in life, is, of course, part of the community.
Okay.
Is this a new person?
Yep, he's a caller. So Andrew in Ireland, again, welcome back.
Hello.
Hello there. Yep. You've got a question for Debbie?
It's a bit less of a question, a more kind of case study that I'd like your opinion on. I'm in Northern Ireland, and I go to a Catholic grammar school. Some fucking legal loophole that they're able to Bible bash the living shit out of us. And here's the thing. What we're having is we have to go to a talk on the 10th about, what was the word? It's basically a talk on sex ed from, if I can get the woman's name, it's Pam something or other. She's a crazy religious woman who, rather than preaching, you know, safe sex, she tells, you know, never have sex. If you have sex, you will die. And that's basically what she's saying. And, you know, before I heard about this, I was in my general RE class, which is just laughable, which teaches you to love Jesus as much as you can. And we're sitting in this class, and we get to watch this video of her preaching in America. I'm not even saying it's a talk, it's a fucking preaching session. Because she gets up and she starts saying, you know, I love talking to private schools because I can't say this in public school. Sex is from God and Jesus and all that fluffy goodness.
Yeah. And
so clearly completely unbiased. And to get to my point as I ramble through the shambles of a day, basically I want her not to give this talk because she is vile in every sense of the word, and what she's preaching will lead to horrible consequences. Because she basically preaches, you know, condoms don't work, contraception will leave you fucking lying bloodied in a back alley, some shit like that. And I, like, she'd be preaching this to, like, 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds. I do not want them being infected with that. Is there any way, in your eyes, that I could do that without putting myself up as some kind of target or having to use violence or anything like that?
So you're a student or teacher?
I'm a student.
Okay. And this is a grammar school?
Yeah.
I don't know what ages grammar schools cover.
Okay.
That's 11 to 16 for compulsory, and then up to 18 if they have a sixth form.
Okay. So like the equivalent of my high school, basically.
Yeah.
Right. I think you don't have a recourse, probably. So the question is, what can you do? I went to Catholic school, as I mentioned, for 11 years. I lost my scholarship in Catholic school. And when I started the second angrier version of my philosophy club, I did a lot of – our focuses were things like atheism and secularism, academic freedom issues, church-state separation. And I ended up researching a lot about – you know, private schools, of course, in the U.S. context, but from the bit I know about Ireland, they're even more able to do whatever wacky stuff they like. You know, a private school can decide in the U.S. to do whatever the heck it wants. It's your option to go there. And if you agree to go there, they can kick you out if you've got your ponytail on the wrong side of your head, you know? Anything they want. So if they want to give this basically not based in science, presenting one religious perspective, talk to people that can, probably. So assuming the talk is going to happen, I mean, if we're in the U.S., we could try to get the science teachers together to say this isn't scientific, for example. This isn't based in good science. If she were talking about, you know, abstinence leads to your unicorns coming out of your vagina or something, you could be like, heck no, that doesn't happen. And all of these science teachers have signed this statement saying so. You can try to bring in, like, talk to the administration about bringing in a different speaker who gives a science-based sex ed talk, but maybe in a Catholic grammar school that would never fly.
Especially
one thing we do for Sylvia Brown protests here, since she's, you know, a well-known psychic type, is we hand out things outside of the, we hand out closed envelopes when people are going inside to a Sylvia Brown event, and inside it says basically, here are all the tricks that she uses. She's going to say, anyone here have a name starting with the letter M? Someone with an M? And so it lays out, you know, 12 points of cold reading as a hope that people will see that and then recognize her tricks for what they are. So maybe one thing people could do, of course you risk getting in serious trouble, is hand out information to people about the sorts of wrong information she gives and then what's actually a fact. And if there's a website somewhere that's like Sex Ed 101 that seems neutral and science-based, maybe connecting to that or pulling it off of there. Like she says, you know, all sex before marriage leads to AIDS or something. You can say, no, that's not true. Here's some statistics. Yes, condoms work. Here's some statistics. This is better than that. Here's some statistics. I can't think of anything else, though, and there's a lot of limitations, I'm guessing, because I'm sure there's lots of ways that you and other students could get in trouble. I don't know if you're able to get in trouble for even, like, stuff you post on Facebook at that school. Having a website, writing a couple good things and getting the word out. So you might be pretty limited there, but those are some ideas that might help inspire you to think of something that fits that situation.
Thanks. What you were saying about the Facebook thing kind of is true. I mean, I have a YouTube channel, and I post it pretty much under my own name verbatim. And the problem is the school found out about this, and one of my videos was talking about how Christianity is bullshit, and I was suspended.
Yep.
Yay.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking is probably the case, and, you know, there's not much you can do to fight back against that in a private school, probably, or in a Catholic school. I shouldn't say private. I know your system doesn't work the same. In a Catholic school. Unless there's a history of that, but maybe contacting a... Was it Atheists Ireland? Michael Nugent's group? They might have some ideas or some things that fit the laws and the situation specifically there.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's Atheists Ireland. I think, yeah, there is a kind of secular...
But if it's Northern Ireland, I forget how you guys work.
Secular schooling or something, I think, Michael Nugent's organization. Did you have anything else there, Andrew?
Just a few little... kind of points.
No problem.
What you were saying about, you know, in America with the private school, you know, people saying, you know, it's a choice. Here, the local primary school, the one that I went to, which is like for kids, so I don't know, I think that's elementary school in America. Basically, it was a Catholic school. It wasn't as severe as the school I go to now. But the only other option was a very small, limited establishment. And going on to that secondary level, it was the choice between the academy, which is a school with high success rate, high pass rate, and all that shiny goodness, or an integrated school, which is pretty much secular, and you're pretty much guaranteed to fail every test.
Right. Going. Yeah, that's... That was the problem where I grew up in Philadelphia, too. My local high school has right now a 55% graduation rate. It's got metal detectors to get into the school. I remember one week, rather than the AC, the air conditioning system broke, and rather than open the ground floor windows, they canceled school for a week, because if they'd opened the ground floor windows, then students could pass weapons in. You know, there's murders on the premises. There was a teacher who was raped by a student. It's terrible. And rather than go through that public school system, the only other option we had locally was to send, we being my parents, I wasn't old enough to decide this at the time, but was to send the kids to Catholic school, to the private school, where they could choose who they accepted and who they kicked out, where the academics were higher, where everyone graduated, you know, where everyone was going to go to high school. And I went to a Catholic private all-girls academy for 2 years, and the same was true. And the only reason that it was fine to go to public school when I lost my scholarship was that my parents moved to the suburbs that year, and so I could go to, like, the nice suburban public school where there weren't the same kinds of issues as locally in Philadelphia. And a lot of times that's the choice. You know, here it comes down to a lot of the secular groups are hugely anti the vouchers, because a lot of people – often from the religious right or the conservative side or Republicans, support vouchers because school systems are so terrible. They want to give parents basically a check for what they're paying in taxes and say, you choose the school, whether it's a private school or a charter school or the public school, which takes money out of the public school system that needs it so desperately, which, you know, it's a spiral down. It's terrible. It's an issue that I wish the secular movement cared more about. But I honestly think, actually, this kind of reflects on, like, why African Americans for Humanism exists. I think most people who are in the atheist movement come from a comfortably middle class or upper middle class or above background, and they don't know how crappy some of these schools are here. And so it's not an issue to them when they talk about improving science education. It'd be nice if they joined, like, tutoring programs and helped these schools that have failing science programs, but we the movement don't really care about it because we didn't come from that and we're blind to it. We just don't see it. We don't know about it. I'm hoping that AAH can actually get involved in some of these. It's one of my my dreams for the future. I keep telling people about it, hoping that they kind of pick up the baton and run. And I've talked to a couple people about starting pilot programs in some cities like Chicago, so that we can get secularists and atheists and humanists involved in inner city tutoring programs, hopefully to help make change happen.
Okay, Andrew, is that everything?
That's everything. Thanks for the advice, and I'm going to try my best to work on it and see that. The only little thing is I actually looked up the woman's name. It's Pam Stenzel. I'm butchering that like a...
I don't know, but I'll jot that down and look it up.
Yep. Thanks a million.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Okay, Womble, did you have a question there to follow up on?
I think it was a question from chat. Right. It's from someone that's just logged in on a guest account. And let me scroll up to where it was. It was just wondering how you would feel about working with any international groups. And it's from someone that's saying that they're one of the organisers of the London Black Atheists.
Cool. That's awesome.
I don't know if anybody's said about seeing if they'll call in. So we've not.
Yeah, they said they don't have a Skype account at the moment. Yeah. So.
Oh, I know who it is. They're lovely. They're a lovely person. I've encountered them on one of the meetup groups for London-y stuff. Didn't really, she's not, she used to be Moonrise on Blog TV, but she's not obviously got herself registered because she's been naughty, and I'll have to tell her off.
Right.
I think it's fantastic. I look forward to being in touch with them. I was happy to see something like that start. Let's talk, let's communicate. Let's see what we can do together.
I was going to see if you can email Trolley with Logic and I can pass it on to Debbie for you. So I'll pass on the email address for the show, and then I can forward in Debbie into the conversation. Okay. Is there another question in the chat room, Womble? I haven't been following it too much.
I've been having a look. Not that I can see coming up. There's no questions. What's one of the bits of crazy that you've encountered in your work as CFI that's really made you think, oh my gosh, how on earth can someone be that silly or stupid as to believe and fall for that? What's the bits that's really made your jaw drop to the floor in sheer horror at the stupidity needed?
Oh man, that's a... There was something recently, and I'm trying to remember what happened. See, one of the amazing things is I moved to Buffalo from Philadelphia to work for CFI, and since moving, almost my entire social circle has been my coworkers and kind of my coworkers' friends and my former coworkers. So, like, everyone I know is an atheist. Like, everyone I hang out with is an atheist. It's not even a thing. And that was the case kind of before that. So I read about stuff on the internet. I talk to people about what's going on in their areas, but I don't have to deal with it face-to-face often. And I'm trying to think of what happened recently where I was like, oh, yeah, religious people. I can't remember what it was. We do get some really bizarre letters and emails to CFI from people who are sure that they have, like, the final answer that connects all of these things together, you know, like Jesus plus Nostradamus plus whoever and the future and pyramids and the Illuminati. So that's just kind of a steady stream. And then there are the people who tell us we're going to burn in hell and die. But I can't think of anything recently. If it pops in my head again, I'll mention it. Oh! Okay, there was one thing I had to do on a professional level. You know, I've had a lot of, like, taxi drivers. There are two types of people I don't tell I'm an atheist. Well, three. One is Transportation Security Administration, like the people who pat you down at the airport. Like, I don't wear atheist shirts in the airport generally because those people I don't want to mess with ever. Second is cab drivers. Like, if you're driving me around and you have my life in your hands and you're going to tell me about Jesus, I will listen politely. Like, I am scared in some areas. I'm like, nope. Like, I feel it out. I'm really cautious there. And third is people who serve me food in a restaurant. Like, screw that. I love Jesus. Like, if that's what I need to do to get my food, like, I will. Until the check is coming or something, you know. I tend not to mess with things there. But I got on a radio show. This guy called me to set it up, but he didn't tell me anything about the show, and I had to research it just before I was on for this fellow named Jesse Lee Peterson. He's a American black conservative Republican, the kind who says, like, it's a good thing that slaves were taken from Africa to America because that way they could learn about Christianity. It was God's plan. He's awful. And the conversation started, it was an hour radio show, the conversation started pretty politely. He's like, what's humanism and what do you do, blah, blah, blah. And I was telling him and I was being really polite. Then there was a commercial break and he came back and he said, so I'm speaking here with Debbie Goddard from African Americans for Humanism, and she's telling us about how the humanists, like the abortionists and the homosexualists before, are now targeting the black community, and goes on this whole rant, and this is like, blindsided me, like, what? And he says, yes, they're targeting the black community. They're even targeting, and I didn't remember mentioning this, he's like, they're even targeting college campuses to spread their values. And this is something we hear from a lot of people, that atheists target black community. Because there are no black atheists. They're coming from outside, and they're jumping in to, like, take the blackness away from black people and make them atheists. Anyway, he went on this whole thing, and then he starts comparing us to the homosexualists, which is an even word I heard before, and the abortionists and how they're targeting the black community. And so he goes on this rant and then he pauses and I was like, did you want me to respond to that? And he's like, yeah, tell me what you have to say about what you're doing. And I was like, well, you know, we're helping black atheists who are already black atheists build groups because there are a lot of problems. And I try to do, like, the, because they don't have as many friends, to get, like, the sympathy vote, because they're very lonely, not that we're targeting it. That was kind of, you know, a public, like, holy crap, we're at war now, and I didn't anticipate that interaction.
Okay, everyone, we're coming up for 3 minutes left, so We usually hand it over to our guests. If you want to get on the soapbox and promote anything, you have a few minutes here to do so.
Oh, man, what? Yeah. Open-ended time.
Yeah.
Well, this was super fun, I'll just say. I was glad for the questions. I was glad to get the chance to talk about all the topics that we hit. I did think of one other analogy that was helpful to people I've talked to in the past who are really trying to understand, like, why do black people feel they need to organize separately? And in the U.S., we have some groups, especially in Utah and Arizona and on some college campuses, that are former Mormon groups, ex-Mormon groups. There are certainly former Mormon websites. There are former Muslim groups within the atheist, because they have issues. They have issues to deal with where it would be really great for them to connect with other people with a similar background. And if it seems weird that there are separate groups, that black people, that African Americans are trying to create separate groups, you know, think about the usefulness of a group for former Mormons when Mormonism is so encompassing of a culture in some areas, or former Muslims, and how useful that can be to people, to have an outlet, to have people who understand them for something that's often difficult. We have a website with a lot of resources for African Americans for Humanism. We talk about some free thought black history. We have a list of our local groups. I haven't had a chance to update the announcements in a while, but we keep track of articles that mention black atheists. There's some other good resources there. You can always like our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. A lot of it's AA Humanism, easy to find for African Americans for Humanism. Check out some of the work that the international branches are doing in our campus program too, CFI on campus, if you like. There's a lot happening in the world. And if you're just tuning in and you participate online, you know, you like reading the websites, you like commenting on the blogs, I implore you to get involved. You know, if you can, step up by one. If you're just participating by commenting on blogs and listening to podcasts, see if you're interested in joining a local group. See if you're interested in donating to something regularly that you support. You know, see what you can do, whatever your circumstances. I'm sure there's like one step you can take up to help this movement to make change, to change the world, because it's important. And I guess that's my soapbox for now.
All right. Thank you very, very much, Debbie. It's been fantastic. Thank you, Womble, for joining in halfway through as well.
No problem.
And as always, thank you, Martimer, for co-hosting.
My pleasure.
And Martimer, do you want to say who next week's guest is?
Yeah, next week we will be having Sean M. Carroll on the show. He's a cosmologist.
Physicist.
Who I will be wanting to have quite a long chat with, I think, because I have plenty of questions in that field.
Okay.
There's a chance the audience might get, they might glaze over.
Yeah,
something.
I think we might just geek out altogether.
Well, of course they will. It's not going to be about rocks.
But there's a high probability we're going to geek out on that one with you, Marty. So.
Yeah, and the week after that, we're doing the intellectual opposite of a cosmologist, because we're doing a live pwnage of Ian Juby.
Anyway, on that note, we'll all say goodnight. We're back again same time next week. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and have a good evening or a good afternoon, wherever you are.
Yeah, bye, everyone.